Side 5. Azazel by Isaac Asimov. Continuing with The Mind's Construction on page 174. Van Deventer came to me perhaps a week later, a look of concern on his patrician face. "Uncle George," he said, "a most unusual thing has happened. I was questioning a young man involved in the robbery of a liquor store. He was telling me in the most affecting detail that he just happened to be passing the store, deep in thought over his poor mother, who was suffering from a headache which had struck her after she had consumed half a bottle of gin. He stepped into the store to ask if it was, after all, wise to consume gin too soon after having disposed of a similar quantity of rum, when the owner, for no reason he could tell, pressed a gun into his hands and then began shoving the contents of the cash register at the young man, who, confused and astonished, accepted it, just as a policeman walked in. He said he thought it was intended as compensation for the pain his dear mother had experienced. He was telling me all this when it came over me in the oddest way that he was, fibbing." "Indeed?" "Yes. It is the most amazing thing I ever experienced." Van Deventer's voice fell to a whisper. "Not only did I know somehow that the young man had the gun with him when he entered, but that his mother did not have a headache. Can you imagine someone fibbing about his mother?" Close investigation proved Van Deventer's instinct to be correct in every particular. The young man had been telling an untruth about his mother. From that moment on, Van Deventer's ability sharpened steadily. Within a month, he had become a keen, hard-eyed, remorseless machine for the detection of falsehood. The department watched in gasping amazement as accused after accused failed in the attempt to hoodwink Van Deventer. No tale of having been deeply immersed in prayer at the time the poor box was rifled could stand up against his shrewd questioning. Lawyers who had been investing orphans' funds in the renovation of their offices, entirely through oversight, were quickly discomfited. Accountants who had accidentally subtracted a telephone number from the item labeled tax due were trapped in their own words. Drug dealers who had merely picked up a 5-kilo packet of heroin in the local cafeteria, thinking it was sugar substitute, were instantly tied in logical knots. Van Deventer the Victorious, they called him, and the commissioner himself, to the applause of the assembled body of police, awarded Van Deventer a key that fit the lavatory door, to say nothing of moving his office to one side of the corridor. I was congratulating myself that all was well, and that Van Deventer, his success assured, was now ready to marry the lovely Minerva Schlump, when Minerva herself appeared at the doorway of my apartment. "Oh, Uncle George," she whispered faintly, her lithe body swaying. She was clearly on the point of fainting. I lifted her and held her close to me for 5 or 6 minutes, while I considered exactly into which chair I might lower her. "What is it, my dear?" I asked, after I had slowly disencumbered myself of her and smoothed her clothing lest it be disarranged. "Oh, Uncle George," she said, and tears overflowed her lovely lower lids. "It's Van Deventer." "Surely he has not shocked you with unwanted and improper advances." "Oh, no, Uncle George. He is far too refined a person to do that before marriage, although, of course, I have carefully explained to him that I understand the hormonal influences that sometimes overpower young men, and that I was certainly fully prepared to forgive him in case of an untoward event. Yet, despite my assurances, he remains in control."
"What is it, then, Minerva?"
"Oh, Uncle George, he has broken our engagement."
"That is unbelievable. No two people are better suited. Why?"
"He says I'm a teller of inexactitudes."
My reluctant lips formed the word liar. She nodded.
"That vile word did not cross his lips, but that is what he meant. It was only this morning that he looked upon me with his dear glance of melting adoration and said, 'Loved one, have you always been true to me?' And, as I always do, I said sentimentally, 'As true as the sunbeam to the sun, as the rose petal to the rose.'
And then his eyes grew narrow and hateful, and he said, "Aha! Your words are not in accord with verity. You have told a taradiddle." It was as though I had been struck with a heavy blow. I said, "Vandeventer, my own, what are you saying?" He answered, "What you heard. I have been mistaken in you, and we must part forever." And he left. Oh, what am I to do? What am I to do? Where will I find another success?
I said thoughtfully, "Vandeventer is usually right about such things, in recent weeks at any rate. Have you been untrue to him?" A faint flush mantled Minerva's cheeks.
"Not really."
"How unreally?"
"Well, some years ago, when I was but a slip of a girl, aged 17, I kissed a young man. I held him tightly, I admit, but that was only in order to keep him from escaping, and not out of any personal affection."
"I see."
"It was not a very pleasurable experience." "Not very." "After I met Vandeventer, I was astonished to find how much more gratifying his kiss was than the one I had earlier experienced with the other young man. Naturally, I was intent on re-experiencing that gratification. Through all my relationship with Vandeventer, I have, periodically, entirely in a mood of scientific inquiry, kissed other young men in order to assure myself that not one can match my own Vandeventer. In doing so, I assure you, Uncle George, I granted them every advantage in style and form of kissing, to say nothing of grip and squeeze. And never did they match Vandeventer in any way. And yet he says I am untrue."
"How ridiculous," I said. "My child, you have been wronged." I kissed her 4 or 5 times and said, "There, that does not gratify you as Vandeventer's kisses do, does it?"
"Let's see,"
she said, and kissed me 4 or 5 more times with great skill and ardor.
"Of course not,"
she said. "I shall go see him," I said. That very night I presented myself at his apartment. He was sitting moodily in his living room, loading and unloading his revolver. "You are," I said, "doubtless considering suicide."
"Never," he said with a hacking laugh. "What reason have I to commit suicide? The loss of a trifling jade? Of a storyteller? She is well done with, say I."
"You say wrong. Minerva has always been true to you. Her hands, her lips, and her body have never made contact with the hands, the lips, and the body of any man but yourself."
"I know that is not so," said Vandeventer.
"I tell you it is so," I said. "I have spoken with the weeping maiden at length, and she has revealed to me the innermost secrets of her life. Once she blew a kiss at a young man. She was 5 years old at the time, he 6, and she has agonized over that moment of amorous madness ever since. Never has such a scene of ribaldry been repeated, and it is only that moment that you detected in her."
"Are you telling the truth, Uncle George?"
"Consider me with your unfailing and penetrating glance, and I will repeat what I have just said, and then you tell me if I am telling the truth." I repeated the tale, and he said, wondering,
"You are telling the exact and literal truth, Uncle George. Do you suppose that Minerva will ever forgive me?"
"Of course," I said. "Humble yourself to her, and continue your keen pursuit of the dregs of the underworld through every liquor store, corporate boardroom, and city hall corridor. But never, never turn your keen eyes on the woman you love. Perfect love is perfect trust, and you must trust her perfectly."
"I will, I will," he cried out.
And he has done so ever since. He is now the best-known detective on the force, and has been promoted to the rank of half-class detective, with an office in the basement right next to the laundry machine. He is married to Minerva, and they live together in ideal peace. She spends her life testing the superior gratification of Vandeventer's kisses over and over in an ecstasy of happiness. There are times when she will willingly spend the entire night with some likely man who seems suitable for investigation, but always the result is the same. Vandeventer is the best.
She is now the mother of two sons, one of whom bears a slight resemblance to Vandevanter. And so much for your claim, old man, that my labors and those of Azazel always lead to disaster. As it happens, though, I said, if I accept your story, you were lying when you told Vandevanter that Minerva had never touched another man. I did it to save an innocent young maiden. But how is it that Vandevanter did not detect the lie? I presume, said George, wiping the cream cheese from his lips, that it was my air of unassailable dignity. I have another theory, I said. I think that neither you, nor your blood pressure, nor the electrical conductivity of your skin, nor your subtle hormonal reactions, can any longer tell the difference between what is true and what is not. And neither can anyone else who must depend on the data derived from studying you. Ridiculous, said George. The Fights of Spring. We were looking across the river at the college campus on the other side, George and I, and George, having dined to repletion at my expense, was moved to a lachrymose nostalgia. Ah, college days, he moaned. What can we find in life thereafter to compensate for your loss? I stared at him in surprise. Don't tell me you went to college. He favored me with a haughty glare. Do you realize I am the greatest president the fraternity of Phi Fo Fum ever had? But how did you pay the tuition? Scholarships, he said. They were showered on me after I showed my prowess in the food fights, celebrating our victories in the co-ed dormitories. That, and a well-to-do uncle. I didn't know you had a well-to-do uncle, George. After the 6 years it took me to complete the decelerated program, he wasn't any longer, alas. At least, not as much. What money he could save from the wreck, he eventually left to a home for indigent cats, making several remarks about me in his last will and testament that I scorn to repeat. Mine has been a sad and unappreciated life. Sometime in the distant future, I said, you must tell it all to me, omitting no detail. But, continued George, the memory of college days suffuses all my hard life with a glow of pearl and gold. I felt it in its full force a few years back when I revisited the campus of old Tate University. They invited you back? I said, almost succeeding in stifling the unmistakable note of incredulity in my voice. They were about to, I'm certain, said George. But I returned, actually, at the request of a dear comrade of my collegiate years, old Antiochus Schnell. Since you are clearly fascinated by what I have already said, said George, let me tell you about old Antiochus Schnell. He was my inseparable pal in the old days, my Fidus Achates, though why I waste classical allusions on an nincompoop like you, I'll never know. Even now, though he has aged much more drastically than I have, I remember him as he was in the days when we swallowed goldfish together, filled telephone booths with our cronies, and removed panties with deft twists of the wrists to the delighted squeals of dimple-cheeked co-eds. In short, we savored all the lofty pleasures of an enlightened institution. So when old Antiochus Schnell asked me to see him on a matter of great moment, I was there at once. George, he said, it's my son.
Young Artaxerxes Schnell?
The same. He is a sophomore at old Tate University, but things are not going well with him.
My eyes narrowed. Has he fallen in with a worthless crowd? Is he running into debt? Has he foolishly allowed himself to be entrapped by an elderly beer hall waitress?
Worse, much worse,
said old Antiochus Schnell in broken syllables.
He has never told me so himself. Hadn't the face for it, I suppose, but a shocked letter from one of his classmates, written in the strictest confidence, has reached me. George, old friend, my poor son, let me say it straight out without searching for euphemisms, is studying calculus.
Studying calc? I couldn't bring myself to say the awful word. Old Antiochus Schnell nodded forlornly.
And political science, too. He's actually attending class, and he has been seen studying.
Great heavens,
I said, appalled.
I can't believe it of young Artaxerxes, George. If his mother should hear of it, it would be her end. She's a sensitive woman, George, and not in good health. I conjure you, in the name of our ancient friendship, to go to old Tate and investigate the matter. If the boy has been lured into scholarship, bring him to his senses somehow, for his mother's sake and his own, if not for mine.
With tears in my eyes, I wrung his hand. Nothing shall deter me, I said. No consideration on earth shall swerve me from this holy task. I shall spend the last drop of my blood, if necessary. And speaking of spending, I will need a check.
A check?
Quavered old Antiochus Schnell, who has always been a quick man at slapping the wallet shut. Hotel room, I said. Meals, drinks, allowance for tips, inflation and overhead. It's for your son, old fellow, not for me. I finally got that check and did not wait long after having arrived at Tate before arranging to meet young Artaxerxes. I barely took the time to have a good dinner, an excellent brandy, a long night's sleep, and a leisurely breakfast before I was calling on him in his room. It was quite a shock entering that room. On every wall there were shelves filled not with bric-a-brac to catch the eye, not with nutritious bottles replete with the vintner's art, not with photographs of winsome lassies who had unaccountably lost their clothes, but with books. One book lay unashamedly open on his desk, and I do believe he had been fingering it just before I had arrived. There was a suspicious dustiness about his right index finger, and he clumsily tried to hide it behind his back. But Artaxerxes himself was an even greater shock. He recognized me, of course, as an old friend of the family. I had not seen him for 9 years, but 9 years had not changed my noble carriage or my fresh and open countenance. 9 years before, however, Artaxerxes had been an unimpressive boy of 10. Now he was an unrecognizable but entirely unimpressive youth of 19. He was barely 5'5", wore large round glasses, and had a caved-in appearance. "How much do you weigh?" I asked impulsively. 97 pounds, he whispered. I stared at him in heartfelt pity. He was a 97-pound weakling. He was the natural butt of scorn and derision. And then my heart softened as I thought, poor boy, poor boy. With a body like that, could he take part in any of the activities essential to a well-rounded college education? Football, track, wrestling, chug-a-lugging? When other youngsters cried out, we've got this old barn, we can sew our own costumes, let's put on a musical play of our own. What could he do? With lungs like that, could he sing anything but a faint soprano? Naturally, he was forced, against his will, to slide into infamy. I said softly, almost tenderly, Artaxerxes, my boy, is it true you are studying calculus and political economy? He nodded. Anthropology, too. I stifled an exclamation of disgust. I said, and is it true that you attend classes?
I'm sorry, sir, but I do. At the end of this year, I will make the dean's list.
There was a telltale tear in the corner of one of his eyes, and in the midst of my horror, I found myself able to extract hope from the fact that at least he recognized the sink of depravity into which he had tumbled. I said, my child, can you not even now turn away from these vile practices and return to a pure and unsullied college life?
I cannot, he sobbed. I have gone too far. No one can help me.
I was clutching at straws now. Is there not a decent woman at this college who can take you in hand? Surely the love of a good woman has wrought miracles in the past and can do so again. His eyes lit. I had clearly touched a nerve.
Philomel Cribb, he gasped. She is the sun, moon, and stars that beam down upon the sea of my soul.
Ah, I said, detecting the emotion hidden behind his controlled phraseology. Does she know this?
How can I tell her? The weight of her contempt would crush me.
Would you not give up calculus to wipe out this contempt? He hung his head.
I am weak.
I left him,
determined to find Philomel Cribb at once. It did not take long. I quickly determined at the registrar's that she was majoring in advanced cheerleading, with a strong minor in chorus line dramatics. I found her in the cheerleading studio. I waited patiently for the intricate stomping and melodious shrieking to end, and then had Philomel pointed out to me. She was a blonde girl of middle height, glowing with health and perspiration, and possessing a figure that caused my lips to purse in approval. Clearly, buried under Artaxerxes' scholarly perversion, there beat a dim realization of a collegiate's proper interests. After she had emerged from her shower and donned her colorful and skimpy collegiate dress, she came to meet me, appearing as fresh and bright as a dew-sprinkled field. I got to the heart of the matter at once, saying, "Young Artaxerxes considers you the astronomical illumination of his life." It seemed to me her eyes softened a bit. "Poor Artaxerxes, he needs so much help." "He could use some from a good woman," I pointed out.
"I know," she said, "and I'm as good as they come, or so I am told."
And here she blushed prettily.
"But what can I do? I cannot go against biology. Bullwhip Costigan endlessly humiliates Artaxerxes. He sneers at him in public, pushes him about, knocks his silly books to the ground, all to the cruel laughter of the assembled multitude. You know how it is in the ebullient air of springtime."
"Ah, yes," I said feelingly, remembering the happy days and the many, many times I had held the contestants' coats. "The fights of spring." Philomel sighed.
"I have long hoped Artaxerxes would stand up to Bullwhip somehow. A footstool would help, of course, considering that Bullwhip is 6'6". But for some reason, Artaxerxes will not. All that studying," she shuddered, "weakens the moral fiber."
"Undoubtedly. But if you helped him out of this slough..."
"Oh, sir, he is deep underneath, a kindly and thoughtful young man, and I would help him if I could. But the genetic equipment of my body is paramount, and it calls me to Bullwhip's side. Bullwhip is handsome, muscular, and dominating, and these qualities naturally impress their way into my cheerleader's heart."
"And if Artaxerxes were to humiliate Bullwhip?"
"A cheerleader," she said, and here she drew herself up proudly, offering an astonishing display of frontal obtrusiveness, "must follow her heart, which would inevitably recede from the humiliatee and advance toward the humiliator."
Simple words that came, I knew, from the soul of the honest girl. My course was plain. If Artaxerxes ignored the trifling deficit of 13 inches and 110 pounds and ground Bullwhip Costigan into the mire, Philomel would be Artaxerxes and would convert him into a true blue male, who would age gracefully toward a lifetime of useful beer swigging and TV football watching. Clearly, it was a case for Azazel. I don't know if I have ever told you of Azazel, but he is a 2-centimeter being from another time and place, whom I can call to my side through secret spells and incantations to which I alone have the key. Azazel possesses powers far beyond ours, but he is otherwise without redeeming social qualities, for he is an exceedingly selfish creature who consistently places his own petty concerns over my important needs. This time, when he appeared, he was lying on his side, his tiny eyes closed and his little whiplash of a tail slowly caressing the empty air before him with soft, languorous strokes. "Mighty one," I said, for he insists on being addressed so. His eyes opened, and he at once emitted ear-piercing whistles at the upper range of my hearing. Very unpleasant.
"Where is Ashtaroth?" he called out. "Where is my own precious Ashtaroth, who at this very moment was in my arms?"
Then he noticed me and said, grinding his tiny teeth,
"Oh, it's you! Are you aware that you called me to your side at the very moment when Ashtaroth..." "But that is neither here nor there."
"Nor yon," I said. "Still, consider that after you've helped me out a bit, you can return to your own continuum 30 minutes after you left. Ashtaroth will then have had time to grow disturbed over your sudden absence, but not yet furious. Your reappearance will fill her with joy, and whatever was being done can be done a second time. Azazel thought for a moment, and then said, in what was for him a gracious tone,
"You have a small mind, primitive worm, but it is a devious one, and that can be of use to us who are of giant mentalities, but who are hampered by a candid and luminously straightforward nature. What sort of help do you need now?"
I explained the plight of Artaxerxes, and Azazel considered it and said,
"I could increase the power output of his muscles."
I shook my head. "It is not a matter of muscle alone. There are skill and courage, which he badly needs." Azazel said indignantly,
"Do you want me to sweat my tail off, increasing his spiritual qualities?"
"Have you anything else to suggest?"
"Of course I have. Am I infinitely superior to you for nothing? If your weakling friend cannot assault his enemy directly, what about effective evasive action?"
"You mean running away very speedily?" I shook my head. "I don't think that would be very impressive."
"I didn't speak of flight. I mean evasive action. I need only greatly abbreviate his reaction time, which is simply done by one of my vast attainments. In order to avoid having him waste his strength needlessly, I can have such abbreviation activated by adrenal discharge. It will be operative, in other words, only when he is in a state of fear, rage, or other strong passion. Just allow me to meet him briefly, and I will take care of it all."
"Certainly," I said. In a matter of a quarter of an hour, I visited Artaxerxes in his dormitory room and allowed Azazel to peep at him from my shirt pocket. Azazel was thus able to manipulate the young man's autonomic nervous system at close range, and then to go back to his Ashtaroth and to whatever foul practices he wished to indulge in. My next step was to write a letter cleverly disguised in a collegiate hand, block lettering in crayon, and slip it under Bullwhip's door. There was not long to wait. Bullwhip put a message on the student bulletin board summoning Artaxerxes to meet him in the taproom of the Guzzling Gourmet, and Artaxerxes knew better than to refuse. Philomel and I came too, and remained at the outskirts of a crowd of jolly collegiates anxious to see the excitement. Artaxerxes, his teeth chattering, carried a weighty tome entitled Handbook of Chemistry and Physics. Even in this extreme crisis, he could not rid himself of his addiction. Bullwhip, standing tall and with his muscles, under his carefully torn T-shirt, rippling in a manner fearsome to behold, said,
"Schnell, it has come to my attention that you have been telling lies about me. Being a true blue college lad, I will give you a chance to deny this before I shred you. Have you told anyone you once saw me reading a book?"
Artaxerxes said,
"I once saw you looking at a comic book, but you were holding it upside down, so I didn't think you were reading it. So I never told anyone you were."
"Did you ever say that I was afraid of girls and talked big about what I couldn't do big?"
Artaxerxes said, "I heard some girls say so once, Bullwhip, but I never repeated it." Bullwhip paused. The worst was yet to come.
"Okay, Schnell. Did you ever say I was a closet nerd?"
Artaxerxes said,
"No, sir. What I said was you were positively absurd."
"Then you deny everything?"
"Emphatically."
"And admit it's all untrue?"
"Vociferously."
"And that you're a dirty liar, pants on fire?"
"Abjectly."
"Then,"
said Bullwhip through clenched teeth,
"I won't kill you. I'll merely break an obscure bone or two."
"The fights of spring,"
called out the collegians, laughing as they made a ring about the two combatants.
"This will be a fair fight,"
announced Bullwhip, who, although a cruel bully, followed the collegiate code.
"Nobody is to help me, and nobody is to help him. It is to be strictly one-on-one."
"What could be fairer?"
chorused the eager audience. Bullwhip said,
"Take off your glasses, Schnell."
"No,"
said Artaxerxes boldly,
whereupon one of the onlookers removed the glasses for him.
Hey, said Artaxerxes, you're helping Bullwhip.
No, I'm not. I'm helping you, said the collegiate, who was now holding the glasses.
But now I can't see Bullwhip clearly, said Artaxerxes.
Don't worry, said Bullwhip. You will feel me clearly.
Without more ado, he swung his ham-like fist at Artaxerxes' chin. It whistled through the air, and Bullwhip swung half around, for Artaxerxes had faded back at the approach of the blow, which missed him by a quarter of an inch. Bullwhip looked astonished. Artaxerxes looked flabbergasted.
That does it, said Bullwhip. Now you'll get it.
He moved forward, and his arms pumped in alternation. Artaxerxes danced right and left with a look of extreme anxiety on his face, and I really feared he might catch cold from the wind of Bullwhip's mighty flailing. Bullwhip was clearly tiring. His mighty chest heaved.
What are you doing?
He demanded querulously. Artaxerxes, however, had by now realized that he was, for some reason, invulnerable. He therefore walked toward the other, and lifting the hand that was not holding the book, slapped Bullwhip's cheek soundly, saying, Take that, you nerd! There was a synchronized sharp gasp from the audience, and Bullwhip went into a frenzy. All one could see was a powerful piece of machinery, lunging, striking, and whirling, with, at its center, a dancing, swaying target. After interminable minutes, there was Bullwhip, breathless, face streaming with perspiration, and utterly helpless with fatigue. Before him stood Artaxerxes, cool and untouched. He had not even dropped his book. He shoved that book now hard into Bullwhip's solar plexus, and when Bullwhip doubled up, Artaxerxes brought it down even harder on Bullwhip's skull. The book was very badly damaged as a result, but Bullwhip collapsed in a state of blissful unconsciousness. Artaxerxes looked about myopically. He said, Will the scoundrel who took my glasses return them now?
Yes, sir, Mr. Schnell, said the collegiate who had taken them.
He smiled spasmodically in a placatory effort. Here they are, sir. I have cleaned them, sir.
Good. Now scram. That goes for all you nerds. Scram!
They did so, standing not upon the order of going, but hurtling over one another in their anxiety to be elsewhere. Only Philomel and I lingered. Artaxerxes' eye fell upon the panting young girl. With a haughty lift of his eyebrows, he crooked his little finger. Humbly she came to him, and as he turned on his heel and left, she, just as humbly, followed him. It was a happy ending all around. Artaxerxes, filled with self-confidence, found he no longer needed books to give him a spurious sensation of worth. He spent all his time in the boxing ring becoming collegiate champion. He was worshipped by all the young co-eds. But in the end, he married Philomel. His boxing prowess had given him so clear a reputation for collegiate worth that he had his choice of positions as junior business executive. His keen brain made it possible for him to see where the money lay, so he managed to procure the toilet seat concession for the Pentagon, to which he added the sales of items such as washers that he bought at the hardware store and then sold to government procurement agencies. It turned out, though, that his studies in his early nerdish days have stood him in good stead after all. He claims that it takes calculus for him to work out his profits, political economy to get his deductions past the IRS, and anthropology to deal with the executive branch of the government. I stared at George with disbelief. Do you mean to say that this case of you and Azazel interfering with some poor innocent ended happily?
Certainly, said George.
But that means you now have an extremely rich acquaintance who is beholden to you for everything he has. You express it perfectly, old fellow.
But then surely you can put the bite on him.
And here George's brow darkened. You would think so, wouldn't you? You would think there would exist gratitude in the world, wouldn't you? You would think there would be individuals who, when it is carefully explained to them that their superhuman evasive abilities resulted entirely from the arduous labors of a friend, would see fit to shower rewards upon that friend.
You mean Artaxerxes doesn't?
That's right.
When I approached him at one time with a request that he let me have $10,000 as an investment in a scheme of mine that would surely pay back 100-fold, a paltry $10,000 which he makes whenever he sells a dozen cheap screws and bolts to the armed forces, he had me thrown out by a flunky. But why, George? Did you ever find out? Yes, I did, eventually. You see, old chap, he takes evasive action whenever his adrenaline flows, whenever he is in a strong passion, such as anger or rage. Azazel explained that. Yes? And so? And so, whenever Philomel considers the family finances and feels a certain libidinous ardor steal over her, she approaches Artaxerxes, who, detecting her intention, feels his own adrenaline flow in passionate response. Then, when she lunges at him in her girlish enthusiasm and abandon, well, he evades her. Ah! In fact, she can never lay a hand on him any more than Bullwhip could. The longer this goes on, the more his frustration level rises, and the more his adrenaline flows at the mere sight of her, and the more efficiently and automatically he evades her. She, of course, in weeping despair, is forced to find solace elsewhere. But when he tries an occasional adventure outside the strict bonds of matrimony, he cannot. He evades every young woman who approaches him, even when it's a mere matter of business convenience on her part. Artaxerxes is in the position of Tantalus. The stuff is forever available to all appearances, and yet forever out of reach. George's voice grew indignant at this point. And for this piddling inconvenience, he has me thrown out of the house. You might, I said, get Azazel to remove the curse. I mean, the gift you wished upon him. Azazel has a strong objection to operating on a particular individual twice. I don't know why. Besides, why should I do additional favors for someone who is so ungrateful for favors already done him? In contrast, look at you. Occasionally you, even though a well-known niggard, will lend me a fiver. I assure you I keep track of all those occasions on little scraps of paper I have here and there, somewhere in my rooms. And yet I have never done you a favor, have I? If you can be helpful without a favor, why can't he with one? I thought about that, and then said, "Listen, George, let's keep me without a favor. Everything is all right with my life. In fact, just to emphasize that I don't want a favor, how about a tenner?" "Oh, well," said George, "if you insist." Galatea. For some reason unknown, especially to myself, I occasionally use George as the repository for my innermost feelings. Since he has an enormous and overflowing fund of sympathy, all of which is reserved for himself, this is useless, but I do it anyway now and then. Of course, my own fund of self-pity was overflowing at the moment, so perhaps I couldn't help myself. We were waiting for our strawberry shortcake after a substantial lunch at the Peacock Alley, and I said, "I am sick and tired, George, of having critics make no effort to find out what it is I am trying to do. I am not interested in what they would do if they were I. After all, they can't write or they wouldn't waste their time being critics. And if they can write after a fashion, the only function their criticisms offer them is a chance to chip away at their superiors. What's more..." But the strawberry shortcake arrived, and George seized the opportunity to take over the conversation, something that he would have done at about that point even if the dessert had not arrived. "Old boy," he said, "you must learn to take the vicissitudes of life calmly. Tell yourself, for it is true, that your miserable writings have so little effect on the world that what reviewers may say, if they bother to say anything at all, is totally without consequence. Thoughts of this kind will greatly relieve you and prevent your developing an ulcer. You might particularly avoid such maudlin speech in my presence, as you would if you had the sensitivity to realize that my work is far more important than yours, and the reviews I receive are, on occasion, far more devastating." "Are you going to tell me you write too?" I said sardonically, digging into the cake. "No," said George, digging into his. "I am that far more important individual, a benefactor of humanity, a berated, unappreciated benefactor of humanity. I could swear that a suspicion of a tear slightly dampened his eyes. I don't see, I said kindly, how anyone's opinion of you can possibly sink so low as to be considered an underappreciation. I ignore the sneer, said George, since it originates with you, and will tell you that I am thinking of that beautiful woman, Elderberry Muggs. Elderberry? I said with a touch of incredulity. Elderberry was her name, said George. I do not know why her parents should have named her so, though it might well have commemorated a tender moment in their prenuptial relationship. It was Elderberry's own suggestion that both her parents were a bit tiddly with elderberry wine during the activities that gave her her start in life. She might not have had the chance for such a start otherwise. In any case, her father, who was an old friend of mine, asked me to be godfather at her christening, and I could not refuse him. A great many friends of mine, impressed by my noble appearance and by my ingenuous and virtuous countenance, can only feel at ease in church with me next to them, so that I have had a great many godfatherships to my credit. Naturally, I take these things seriously and feel the responsibility of the post keenly. I therefore remain as close to my godchildren as possible in later life, all the more so when they grow up to be as supernally beautiful as Elderberry. Her father died at just about the time Elderberry turned 20, and she inherited, as it happened, a substantial sum of money, which, naturally, increased her beauty in the eyes of the world generally. I am myself above making a great to-do over mere trash such as money, but I did feel it necessary to guard her from fortune hunters. For that, I made it my business to cultivate her society to an even greater extent, and frequently dined at her home. After all, she was very fond of her Uncle George, as you can well imagine, and I, for one, certainly can't blame her for that. As it further happened, Elderberry did not quite need the nest egg her father had left her, for she turned out to be a sculptor of renown, producing works whose artistic value could not be questioned, since they commanded high prices at the marketplace. I myself did not quite understand her output, for my taste in art is quite ethereal, and I cannot expect to appreciate the things she created for the delectation of that portion of the crass multitude who could afford her prices. I remember on one occasion asking her what a particular piece of sculpture represented. "As you see," she said, "the work is labeled Stork in Flight." I studied the object, which was cast in the finest bronze, and said, "Yes, I noticed the label, but where is the stork?" "Here," she said, pointing to a small cone of metal that arose from a rather amorphous bronze base and came to a sharp point. I regarded it thoughtfully, then said, "Is that a stork?" "Certainly it is, you old clotpole," she said, for she always addressed me in affectionate terms. "It represents the tip of the stork's long bill." "Is that enough, Elderberry?" "Absolutely," said Elderberry. "It is not the stork itself I am attempting to represent, but the abstract notion of storkness, which is exactly what this brings to mind." "Yes, it does," I said, slightly bemused, "now that you mention it. Still, the label says that the stork is in flight. How does that come about?"
"Why, you ninny puss," she exclaimed, "don't you see this rather amorphous bronze base?"
"Yes," I said, "it rather forces itself on my attention."
"And you won't deny that the air, or any gas if it comes to that, is an amorphous mass. Well, then, this rather amorphous bronze base is a crystal clear representation of the atmosphere in the abstract. And you see that on this face of the base, there is a thin, straight line, absolutely horizontal."
"Yes. How clear it is once you point it out."
"That is the abstract notion of flight through the atmosphere."
"Remarkable," I said. "Luminously clear once it is explained. How much will you get for it?"
"Oh,"
she said, waving one hand negligently, as though to emphasize the nothingness of it all.
$10,000, perhaps. It is so simple and self-evident a thing, I would feel guilty charging more. It is more a more so than anything else.
Not like that. And she waved toward a mural on the wall constructed of gunny sacks and pieces of cardboard, with the whole centered about a broken egg beater that seemed to have something that looked like dried egg upon its lower reaches. I looked at it respectfully. "Priceless, of course," I said.
"I should think so," she said. "That's not a new egg beater, you know. It has the patina of age. I got it out of someone's rubbish bag."
And then, for some reason I could not fathom, her lower lip began to tremble, and she quavered,
"Oh, Uncle George!"
I was instantly alarmed. I seized her capable left hand, with its strong sculptor's fingers, and squeezed it. "What is it, my child?"
"Oh, George," she said, "I get so tired working out these simple abstractions just because they represent the public's taste."
She put the knuckles of her right hand to her forehead and said tragically,
"How I wish I could do what I want to do, what my artist's heart tells me I must do."
"What is that, Elderberry?"
"I want to experiment. I want to move off in new directions. I want to try the untried, dare the undared, produce the unproducible."
"Then why don't you do that, my child? Surely you are rich enough to indulge yourself." And she suddenly smiled, and her whole face beamed with loveliness.
"Thank you, Uncle George," she said. "Thank you for saying that. Actually, I do indulge myself, now and then. I have a secret room in which I place my little experiments, those which only the educated artistic palate can possibly appreciate. Those which are caviar to the general," she added, coining a phrase.
"May I see them?"
"Of course, dear uncle. After what you have said in encouragement of my aspirations, how could I deny you?"
She lifted a thick curtain under which one found a secret door that was scarcely visible, so closely did it fit into the wall. She pushed a button, and it opened electrically. We passed in, and as the door closed behind us, brilliant fluorescence lighted the windowless room we had entered and made it as bright as day. Almost at once, I saw before me the representation of a stork, made of a rich, stony material. Every feather was in place. The eyes were bright with life, the bill a little open, the wings half outspread. To my eyes, it seemed ready to launch itself into the air. "Good heavens, Elderberry," I said. "I have never seen anything like this."
"Do you like it? I call it photographic art, and I think it is beautiful in its way. Thoroughly experimental, of course, and critics and public alike would laugh and sneer and fail to see what I am trying to do. They honor only simple abstractions, which exist entirely on the surface, and which anyone can understand. Nothing like this, which can appeal only to the subtle, and to those who are content to allow comprehension to dawn slowly."
After that, I was privileged to enter her secret room now and then, and to study the occasional bit of exotica that formed under her strong fingers and educated chisel. My admiration at a woman's head that looked exactly like Elderberry's own was profound.
"I call it the mirror," she said, dimpling shyly. "It pictures my soul, don't you think?"
I agreed enthusiastically. It was that, I think, which finally induced her to allow me to see the innermost secret of all. I had said to her, "Elderberry, how is it that you do not have any..." I paused, and then, scorning euphemisms, completed the sentence with, "Any boyfriends?"
"Boyfriends," she said with a look of deep scorn. "Pah! They flock around, these would-be boyfriends you speak of. But how can I look at them? I am an artist. I have in my heart and mind and soul a picture of true manly beauty that no mere flesh and blood can duplicate, and that alone can win my heart. That and that alone has won my heart."
"Has won your heart, my child?" I said softly. "Then you have met him?"
"I have.
But come, Uncle George, you shall see him. You and I shall share my great secret.
We returned to the room of photographic art, and there another thick curtain was pulled aside so that we stood before an alcove I had never seen before. There in the alcove was the statue of a man, 6 feet tall and nude, which was, as far as I could see, anatomically correct to the last millimeter. Elderberry pushed a button, and the statue slowly turned on its pedestal, its smooth symmetry and perfect proportions evident from every angle.
"My masterpiece," breathed Elderberry.
I am not myself a great admirer of manly beauty, but reflected in Elderberry's lovely face, I saw a panting admiration that made it clear she was suffused with love and adoration. "You love that statue," I said, cautiously avoiding the impersonal it.
"Oh, yes," she whispered. "I would die for him. While he exists, I find all other men deformed and hateful. I could never let any man touch me without a sensation of disgust. I want only him. Only him."
"My poor child," I said, "the statue is not alive."
"I know, I know," she said brokenly. "My poor heart is shattered over that. What shall I do?"
I murmured, "How sad. It reminds me of the tale of Pygmalion."
"Of whom?"
said Elderberry, who, like all artists, was a simple soul who knew nothing of the wide outer world. "Of Pygmalion. It is a story of ancient times. Pygmalion was a sculptor just like you, except, of course, that he was a man. And he carved a lovely statue, as you did, except that, because of his peculiar manly prejudices, he carved a woman, whom he called Galatea. The statue was so beautiful that Pygmalion fell in love with it. You see, it is just like your case, except that you are a living Galatea, and the statue is a graven..."
"No," said Elderberry energetically. "Don't expect me to call him Pygmalion. That is a rough, crude name, and I want something poetic. I call him..."
And her face lit up with love again.
"Hank. There is something about the name of Hank, so soft, so musical, that speaks to my very soul. But what happened to Pygmalion and Galatea?"
I said, "Overcome by love, Pygmalion prayed to Aphrodite."
"To whom?"
"Aphrodite, the Greek goddess of love. He prayed to her, and she, out of sympathy, gave life to the statue. Galatea became a living woman, married Pygmalion, and they lived happily ever after."
"Hmm," said Elderberry. "I suppose that Aphrodite doesn't really exist, does she?"
"No, not really. On the other hand..." But I went no further. I didn't think that Elderberry would be able to understand me if I spoke of my 2-centimeter demon, Azazel.
"Too bad," she said. "Because if anyone could bring Hank to life for me, if anyone could change him from cold, hard marble to warm, soft flesh, I would give him... Oh, Uncle George, can't you imagine embracing Hank and feeling the warm softness of his flesh under your hands? Softness, softness."
She kept murmuring the word in an ecstasy of sensual delight. I said, "Actually, dear Elderberry, I don't wish to imagine doing it myself, but I can see that you would find it delectable. But you were saying that if anyone could change him from cold, hard marble to soft, warm flesh, you would give him something. Did you actually have some specific something in mind, dear?"
"Why, yes. I would give him $1,000,000.
I paused, as anyone would, out of simple respect for the sum, and then I said, "Do you have $1,000,000, Elderberry?"
"I have 2,000,000 lovely bucks, Uncle George," she said in her simple and unspoiled way, "and passing out half of them would be fine for me. Hank would be worth it. especially since I could always make more by grinding out a few more abstractions for the public.
So you can, I muttered. Well, you just keep your chin up, Elderberry, and we'll see what your Uncle George can do for you. It was clearly a case for a Zazzle, so I called up my little friend, who happened to look like a little 2-centimeter version of a devil, complete with little nubbins of horns and a twitching spiked tail. He was, as usual, in a bad humor, and he insisted on wasting my time by telling me in rather boring detail just why he was in a bad humor. It appears he had done something of an artistic nature, artistic at least by the standards of his own ridiculous world, for though he described it in detail, I couldn't understand it, and it had been frowned on by the critics. Critics are the same the universe over, I should suppose, worthless and vicious, one and all. At that, though, I think you should be grateful that critics on Earth have some minimum dregs of decency about them. If Azazel may be trusted, what the critics said about him was far beyond anything anyone has said about you. The mildest adjective would call for the horsewhip. It was the similarity of your complaint to his that helped bring this episode to my mind. It was with difficulty that I managed to stem his vituperation long enough to interject a request that he bring a statue to life. He squawked with a shrillness that hurt my ears.
Bring silicate-based material to carbon and water life? Why don't you ask me to build you a planet out of excrement and be done with it? How can I turn stone to flesh?
Surely you can think of a way, O mighty one, I said. Consider that if you achieve this enormous task, you can report it to your world, and then wouldn't the critics feel like a bunch of silly asses?
They are far worse than a bunch of silly asses, said Azazel. If they felt like silly asses, that would exceed their worth by a great deal. Such a feeling would reward them. I want them to feel like a pack of farfel animals.
That is exactly what they will feel like. All you have to do is turn cold into warm, stone into flesh, hard into soft. Especially soft. A young woman I think highly of wants to embrace the statue and feel soft, elastic flesh under her fingertips. It shouldn't be too hard. The statue is a perfect representation of a human being, and you just fill it with muscles, blood vessels, organs, and nerves, and cover it with skin, and you'll have it.
Just fill it with all that, eh? Nothing more, eh?
But think, you will make the critics feel like farfel animals.
There's that. Do you know what a farfel animal smells like?
I don't, but don't tell me. And you can use me as a model.
Model schmodel,
he said peevishly. Where he picks up his expressions, I don't know.
Do you know how complicated even the most rudimentary human brain is?
Well, I said, you don't have to go very far with the brain. Elderberry is a simple girl, and what she wants of the statue does not very deeply involve the brain, I imagine.
You'll have to show me the statue and let me consider the case, he said.
I will, but remember, arrange for the statue to come to life while we are watching, and make sure that it is terribly in love with Elderberry.
Love is easy. That's just a matter of adjusting hormones.
The next day, I managed to get Elderberry to invite me to view the statue again. Azazel was in my shirt pocket, peeping out and emitting feeble, high-pitched snorts. Fortunately, Elderberry had eyes only for her statue, and would not have noticed if 20 full-sized demons had stepped up next to her. Well, I said later to Azazel.
I'll try to do it, he said. I'll fill him with organs based on you. You are a normal representative of your foul and inferior species, I trust.
More than normal, I said haughtily. I am an outstanding specimen.
Very well, then. She shall have her statue entirely encased in soft, warm, palpitating flesh. She will have to wait till noon tomorrow, your time. I can't hurry this.
I understand. She and I will be waiting. The next morning, I phoned Elderberry. Elderberry, my child, I have spoken to Aphrodite. Elderberry said in an excited whisper,
Do you mean she does exist, Uncle George?
In a manner of speaking, dear child, your ideal man will come to life at noon today under our very eyes.
Oh, my,
she said faintly.
You are not deceiving me, are you, Uncle?
I never deceive, I said, and I never do. But I will admit I was a little nervous, for I depended entirely on Azazel. But then, he had never failed me. At noon, we were both at the alcove once more, looking at the statue, which stared stonily into space. I said to Elderberry, Is your watch showing the correct time, dear?
Oh, yes. I check it with the observatory. We have 1 minute to go.
The change may possibly be a minute or two late, of course. It's hard to judge these things exactly.
Surely a goddess ought to be on time, said Elderberry. Otherwise, what's the good of being a goddess?
I call that true faith, and she was justified, for on the second of noon, a tremor seemed to course through the statue. Slowly, his color changed from a dead marble white to a warm flesh pink. Slowly, motion animated his frame. His arms lowered to his side, his eyes gained a blue and glistening life. The hair on his head darkened to a light brown and appeared, wherever appropriate, elsewhere on his body. His head bent, and he looked at Elderberry, who was hyperventilating madly. Slowly, creakily, he stepped down from the pedestal and walked toward Elderberry, arms outstretched. You, Elderberry, me, Hank, he said.
Oh, Hank,
said Elderberry as she melted into his arms. For a long time they stood frozen in the embrace, and then she looked over her shoulder at me, her eyes shining with ecstasy, and said,
Hank and I will remain in the house for a few days as a sort of honeymoon, and then, Uncle George, I will see you.
And she twiddled her fingers as though she were counting money. At that, my eyes shone in ecstasy, too, and I tiptoed out of the house. Frankly, I thought it rather incongruous for a fully dressed young woman to be so warmly embraced by a naked young man, but I was sure that almost immediately upon my leaving, Elderberry would manage to correct the incongruity. I waited 10 days for Elderberry to phone me, but she never did. I was not entirely surprised, for I imagined she was otherwise occupied. Still, after 10 days, I did think there would be a pause for breath, and I further began to think it only fair that, since her ecstasy had been fulfilled entirely through my efforts and Azazel's, it was only fair that my ecstasy be fulfilled too. I went to her place of abode where I had left the happy couple and rang the bell. It was quite a while before there was an answer, and I was having an unpleasant picture of two young people having ecstasied each other to death, when finally the door opened a crack. It was Elderberry, looking perfectly normal, if you count an angry look as perfectly normal. She said,
Oh, it's you!
Why, yes, I said. I was afraid you had left town to continue and extend your honeymoon. I didn't say anything about honeymooning themselves to death. I felt it would not be diplomatic. She said,
And what do you want?
It was not terribly friendly. I could understand that she might not like to be interrupted at her activities, but after 10 days, surely a small interruption was not the end of the world. I said, There's a little matter of $1,000,000, my child. I pushed the door open and walked in. She looked at me with a cold sneer and said,
What you get is bupkis, fella.
I don't know what bupkis are, but I instantly deduced it was a good deal less than $1,000,000. I said, puzzled and more than a little hurt, Why? What's wrong?
What's wrong? She said. What's wrong? I'll tell you what's wrong. When I said I wanted Hank soft, I didn't mean soft all over, permanently.
With her sculptor's strength, she pushed me out the door and slammed it shut. Then, as I stood there nonplussed, she opened it again.
"And if you ever come back, I'll have Hank tear you to pieces. He's strong as a bull in every other way."
So I left. What could I do?
And how do you like that for a critique of my artistic efforts? So don't come to me with your petty complaints.
George shook his head when he completed his story, and looked so despondent that it really touched me. I said, "George, I know you blame Azazel for this, but really it's not the little guy's fault. You emphasized the bit about softness."
"So did she," George said indignantly.
"Yes, but you told Azazel to use you as a model for designing the statue, and surely that would account for the inability..." George lifted his hand in a stop gesture and glared at me. "That," he said, "hurts me even more than the loss of the money I had earned. I'll have you know that, despite the fact that I'm some years beyond my prime..." "Yes, yes, George, I apologize. Here, I believe I owe you $10. Well, $10 is $10, to my relief. George took the bill and smiled. Flight of Fancy. When I dine with George, I am careful not to use a credit card in payment. I pay cash, since that gives George the chance of exercising his amiable habit of scooping up the change. Naturally, I am careful to see to it that the change brought back is not excessive, and I leave a tip separately. We had had lunch on this occasion at the boathouse, and were walking back through Central Park. It was a beautiful day, and just a bit on the warm side, so we sat down on a bench in the shade and relaxed. George watched a bird, seated on a branch in the twitching way birds have, and then followed it with his eyes as it flew away. He said, "When I was a boy, I was outraged that those things could go darting through the air, and I couldn't." I said, "I suppose every child envies the birds, and grown-ups, too. Yet human beings can fly, and they can do so faster and farther than a bird ever could. Look at the plane that circumnavigated the Earth in 9 days, non-stop and without refueling. No bird could do that." "What bird would want to?" said George with contempt. "I'm not talking about sitting in a machine that flies, or even dangling from a hang glider. Those are technological compromises. I mean being in control, flapping your arms gently, then rising and moving at will." I sighed.
"You mean being free of gravity."
"I once dreamed that, George. I once dreamed that I could jump into the air and stay there by the gentlest maneuvering of my arms, and then come down slowly and lightly. Of course, I knew that was impossible, so I assumed I was dreaming. But then, in my dream, I seemed to wake up and find myself in bed. I got out of bed and found I could still maneuver freely in the air. And now, because it seemed to me I had awakened, I believed I could really do it. And then I really woke up and found I was as much a prisoner of gravity as ever. What a feeling of loss I had, what a keen sense of disappointment. I didn't recover for days." And almost inevitably, George said, "I've known worse." "Is that so? You had a similar dream, did you? Only bigger and better?"
"Dreams? I don't traffic with dreams. I leave that to dabbling scriveners like yourself. I'm talking about reality."
"You mean you were really flying? Am I supposed to believe you were in a spaceship in orbit?"
"Not in a spaceship. Right here on Earth. And not me. It was my friend, Balder Anderson. But I suppose I had better tell you the story."
"Most of my friends," said George, "are intellectuals and professional men, as perhaps you might consider yourself to be. But Balder was not. He was a taxi driver, without much education, but with a profound respect for science. Many an evening we spent in our favorite pub,
drinking beer and talking about the Big Bang and the laws of thermodynamics and genetic engineering and so on. He was always very grateful to me for explaining these arcane matters to him, and insisted over my protests, as you may well believe, on picking up the tabs. There was only one unpleasant aspect of his personality. He was an unbeliever. I don't mean your philosophical unbeliever who happens to reject any aspect of the supernatural, who joins some secular humanist organization, and who carefully expresses himself in language that no one understands by way of articles published in magazines that no one reads. What harm is there in that? I mean that Baldo was what in the old days would have been termed the village atheist. He would pick arguments in the pub with people as ignorant of such matters as he was, and they would go at it with loud and scurrilous language. It was not an exercise in rarefied reasoning. The typical argument would go as follows. "Well, if you're so smart, onion head," Balder would say, "tell me where Cain got his wife." "None of your business," his adversary would say. "Because Eve was the only woman alive at the time, according to the Bible," he would say. "How do you know?" "The Bible says so." "It does not. Show me where it says, 'At this time, Eve was the only dame on the whole earth.'" "That's implied." "Implied, my foot? Oh, yeah, yeah." I would reason with Balder during some quiet moments. "Balder," I would say, "there's no reason to argue matters of faith. It won't settle anything, and it just creates unpleasantness." Balder would say belligerently, "It's my constitutional right not to go for the phony baloney stuff and to say so." "Of course," I said. "But one of these days, one of the gentlemen who are consuming alcoholic beverages here might hit you before he stops to remember the Constitution." "Those guys," said Balder, "are supposed to turn the other cheek. It says so in the Bible. It says, 'Don't make a fuss about evil. Leave it be.'" They could forget. "So what if they do? I can handle myself." And indeed he could, for he was a large and muscular man with a nose that looked as though it had stopped many a punch, and fists that looked as though they had exacted exemplary vengeance for such acts. "I'm sure you can," I said, "but in arguments over religion, there are usually several persons in opposition, and only one of you. A dozen people acting in concert might well reduce you to something approaching a pulp. Besides," I added, "suppose you do win an argument over some religious point. You might then cause one of these gentlemen here to lose his faith. Do you really feel you should be responsible for such a loss?" Balder looked troubled, for he was a kindly man at heart. He said, "I never make any remarks about real tender parts of religion. I talk about Cain, and about Jonah not being able to live 3 days in any whale, and about walking on water. I don't say anything really lousy. I don't ever say anything against Santa Claus, do I? Listen, I once heard a guy say right out loud that Santa Claus had only 8 reindeer, and that there was no Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer ever pulling that sleigh. I said, 'Are you trying to make little kids unhappy?' And I popped him one. And I don't let anyone say anything against Frosty the Snowman, either." Such sensitivity touched me, of course. I said to him, "How did you ever get to this state, Balder? What turned you into such a rabid unbeliever?" "Angels," he said, frowning darkly.
"Angels?"
"Yeah. When I was a kid, I saw pictures of angels. You ever see pictures of angels?" "Of course." "They got wings. They got arms and they got legs, and on their backs they got big wings. I used to read books on science when I was a kid, and those books said that every animal that had a backbone had 4 limbs. They got 4 flippers, or 4 legs, or 2 legs and 2 arms, or 2 legs and 2 wings. Sometimes they could lose the 2 hind legs like whales did, or 2 front legs like kiwis did, or all 4 legs like snakes did. but none of them could have more than four. So how come angels have six limbs, two legs, two arms, and two wings? They got backbones, ain't they? They ain't insects or something. I asked my mother how come, and she said to shut up. So then I thought of lots of things like that. I said, actually, Baldur, you can't take those representations of angels literally. Those wings are symbolic. They simply indicate the speed with which angels can move from place to place. Oh, yeah, said Baldur. You ask those Bible guys any time if angels got wings. They believe angels got wings. They're too dumb to understand about six limbs. The whole thing is dumb. Besides, it bothers me about angels. They're supposed to fly, so how come I can't fly? That ain't right. His lower lip thrust out, and he seemed to be on the point of tears. My soft heart melted, and I looked for some way to console him. If it comes to that, Baldur, I said, when you die and go to heaven, you'll get wings along with a halo and a harp, and then you'll be able to fly too. You believe that junk, George? Well, not exactly, but it would be comforting to believe it. Why don't you try? I'm not going to, because it ain't scientific. All my life I've wanted to fly. Personally, just me and my arms. I figure there must be some scientific way to fly by myself, right here on Earth. I still wanted to console him, so I said incautiously, having had perhaps half a drink above my abstemious limit, I'm sure there is a way. He fixed me with a censorious and slightly bloodshot eye. Are you kidding me? He said. Are you making fun of an honest childhood desire? No, no, I said. And it suddenly occurred to me that he had had perhaps a dozen drinks too many, and that his right fist was twitching in a most unpleasant way. Would I make fun of an honest childhood desire? Or even of an adult obsession? I just happen to know a scientist who might know of a way. He still seemed belligerent to me. You ask him, he said, and let me know what he says. I don't like people who make fun of me. It ain't kind. I don't make fun of you, do I? I don't mention that you never pick up a tab, do I? That was treading on dangerous ground. I said hurriedly, I'm going to consult my friend. Don't worry, I'll fix everything up. On the whole, I thought I had better do so. I did not want to cut off my supply of free drinks, and I wanted even less to be the object of Baldur's resentment. He did not believe in the biblical admonitions that he love his enemies, and bless them that curse him, and do good to them that hate him. Baldur believed in popping them in the eye. So I consulted my otherworldly friend, Azazel. Have I ever told you that I have... I have? Well, I consulted him. Azazel was, as usual, in a terrible temper when I brought him in. He held his tail at an unusual angle, and when I inquired about it, he broke into a frenzy of very shrill commentary on my ancestry, matters concerning which he could not possibly have known anything. I gathered he had been accidentally stepped on. He is a very small being, about 2 centimeters tall from the base of his tail to the top of his head, and even on his own world I suspect that he can only succeed in being underfoot. He was certainly under someone's foot on this occasion, and the humiliation of having been too small to be noted had reduced him to frenzy. I said soothingly, if you had the ability to fly, O mighty one, to whom all the universe pays homage, you would not be subject to the clodhoppers of clodhoppers. That rather cheered him up. He kept muttering the final phrase to himself as though he were memorizing it for future use. Then he said, I can fly, O ugly mass of worthless flesh. And I would have flown if I had taken the trouble to note the presence of the lower-class individual who, in his clumsiness, fell up against me. In any case, what is it you want?
He rather snarled as he asked this, though the high pitch of his tiny voice made it sound more like a buzz.
"Smoothly," I said. "Although you can fly, exalted one, there are people on my world who cannot."
"There are no people on your world who can. They are as gross, as swollen, as clumsy, as so many Shaladraconiconia. If you knew anything about aerodynamics, miserable insect, you would know..."
"I bow to your superior knowledge, wisest of the wise,
but it had crossed my mind that you might manage a small amount of anti-gravity."
"Anti-gravity? Do you know how..."
"Colossal mind," I said. "May I have leave to remind you that you have done this before?"
Author's note. See dashing through the snow. End note.
"That, as I recall, was only a partial treatment,"
said Azazel.
"It was barely enough to allow a person to move along the tops of the heaps of frozen water you have on your horrid world. You are now asking, I take it, for something more extreme."
"Yes, I have a friend who would like to fly."
"You have peculiar friends."
He sat down on his tail, as he frequently did when he wished to think, and, of course, jumped up with a thin shriek of agony, having forgotten the contused state of his caudal extremity. I blew on his tail, which seemed to help and mollify him. He said,
"It will take a mechanical anti-gravity device, which, of course, I can get for you, together with the complete cooperation of your friend's autonomic nervous system, assuming he has one."
"I believe he has one," I said. "But how may he achieve the cooperation?"
Azazel hesitated.
"I suppose that what it amounts to is that he must believe he can fly."
I visited Balder 2 days later in his unassuming apartment. I held out the device to him and said, "Here."
It was not an imposing device. It was the size and shape of a walnut, and if one put it to one's ear, one could hear a very faint buzz. What the power source was, I could not say, but Azazel assured me it would not run down. He also said it had to be in contact with the skin of the flyer, so I had put it on a small chain and made a locket of it. "Here," I said again, as Balder shied away from it suspiciously. "Put the chain around your neck and wear it under your shirt."
"Under your undershirt, too, if you have one."
He said,
"What is it, George?"
"It's an anti-gravity device, Balder, the latest thing.
Very scientific and very secret. You must never tell anyone about it."
He reached out for it.
"Are you sure? Did your friend give you this?"
I nodded. "Put it on." Hesitatingly, he slipped it over his head, and with a little encouragement from me, he opened his shirt, let it fall down behind his undershirt, and then buttoned up again.
"Now what?" he said. "Now flap your arms and you'll fly."
He flapped his arms and nothing happened.
His eyebrows hunched in lowering fashion over his small eyes. "Are you making fun of me?"
"No. You've got to believe you're going to fly.
Did you ever see Walt Disney's Peter Pan? Tell yourself, I can fly, I can fly, I can fly." "They had some kind of dust they sprinkled."
"That's not scientific. What you're wearing is scientific. Tell yourself you can fly."
Balder favored me with a long, hard stare, and I must tell you that, although I am as brave as a lion, I felt a bit anxious. I said, "It takes a little time, Balder. You've got to learn how." He was still glaring at me, but he flapped his arms vigorously and said, "I can fly, I can fly, I can fly." Nothing happened.
"Jump,"
I said, give it a little head start. I wondered nervously if Azazel had known what he was doing this time. Balder, still glaring and still flapping, jumped. Up he went in the air about a foot, remained there while I counted three, and then slowly descended. Hey, he said eloquently. Hey, I responded in considerable surprise. I sort of floated there. And very gracefully, I said. Hey, I can fly. Let's try again. He did, and his hair left a distinct greasy spot where he hit the ceiling. He came down, rubbing it.